This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the SportsMap Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, rolling along this morning. Good Tuesday to you. As the NFL season approaches, let's not forget that Major League Baseball is heading into its final month of the season. Great, great race in the AL West as three teams are vying for the top spot. Houston, Texas, and Seattle. Baltimore and Tampa Bay have been duking it out in the East, in the AL East. And then you've got the Cubs trying to catch Milwaukee in the Central, but the Dodgers and the Braves sort of rolling away with it. There is a new energy about the wild card races as there's three teams. You've got in the American League, you've got Tampa Bay, Houston, and Texas. And a half a game back is Toronto. Boston's 4.5 back. It's a little iffy for the Red Sox, but they're still in the conversation. They got the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Cincinnati Reds holding on to the final wild card spot in the National League, right behind both Philadelphia and the Chicago Cubs. And the Miami Marlins are a half a game back. By the way, raise your hand if you were surprised that Miami, I haven't been paying attention to the Marlins all season, and yet they could be in the playoffs this year. San Francisco is a game back. San Diego is 6.5 back. It's a big, big, big mountain to climb, but at least they're relatively in the conversation. But here's the thing. We know that in the offseason, Shohei Ohtani is going to be the big story. What kind of money is he going to get, especially now when he has been shut down for pitching and he still can hit? What is his agent going to do? Well, his agent has come out and said, hey, you know what? He is going to be a two-way player. There will be a procedure done. We don't know any of the details, but that's the case. And he's doing what you should do as an agent. Nez Balio is of CAA is making the case and selling his client's ability to be a two-way player for you. So that's why we still want to have a conversation about that number being $500 million as a starting point. You've got to do this as an agent, even if you're not telling exactly the truth. I do believe that Shohei Ohtani will be back to a two-way player, but I just don't know when. Right? I don't know when. And we talked about this when he was shut down for pitching and not hitting, but shut down for pitching. What would be the strategical part of the way they negotiate going into this offseason? What if every team says, you know what? He's going through his second Tommy John surgery, right? Had one in 2018. We'll have another one again. That's the basic replacement of the UCL. So that causes us to be somewhat concerned. And you know what? You're asking us to commit $500 million to set the new mark for a Major League Baseball player on somebody that might just be a hitter. And here's the thing. If we sign your client to a $500-plus million contract and he's just a hitter, because after he signs the paper, he could look and say, yeah, thanks for the deal. I'll probably just hit more than I pitch while my time with you. Can the Major League Baseball owners put together a contract that says, hey, it's this if it's this, and then it'll be this if it's that? Because that's the only way I would want to do this. I wouldn't want to trust Ohtani's people. We just talked about earlier how some baseball players and basketball players and football players, when they get their deal, they decline. Some players get a deal and they excel. And they continue to be awesome and they continue to be excellent and they continue to pursue championships. But some athletes, you give them the money and then you don't hear from them as much as you did when they were pursuing that contract. Now, I don't know what's in Shohei Ohtani's head and how he's wired and whatnot. I would assume that he's going to want to try to be the best unicorn pitcher he can possibly be and hitter and all that, the kind of two-way player we have not seen since Babe Ruth. But I also know that once you are committed to that contract and $500 million is in your lap and you now know that this is guaranteed money, what's the likelihood that he could say, yeah, the pitching thing, about that. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be working as well as I thought. So what is a strategic play for Shohei Ohtani and his agency? Could it be a two-year deal with the Angels just to get something going, get this repair, work with the trainer, work with people he knows, and then come back as the two-way player in 2 years that everybody thought? You got two more years of age. That's a dangerous spot. Or do you go with faith? Do you go with faith that in the end, owners won't be able to help themselves? that they'll buy into what we're saying about this procedure and how he'll be as good as new, and it'll be the Shohei Ohtani that you fell in love with when he was in the with the Angels and having an MVP season and doing all the things that you know you've not seen one player do before. Because the owner that signed Shohei Ohtani to a $500 million hitting deal is going to be insane. The pitching has to be a part of it. You're not going to give a slugger $500 million. Oh, good Lord, no. Good Lord, no. If you're Pete Alonso, wouldn't you run to the Mets and Steve Cohen and be like, yeah, can we talk? Because I Shohei is getting $500 million. He doesn't have to pitch anymore. No, it has to be $500 million for what we've known Shohei Ohtani to be. So how is he going to sell this? You're not going to be able to know this winter. You have to take their word for it. The only way is that if you somehow get creative with your contract offer, I'll give you $350, you know, for the batting. If he does become a player, we can up it to this. I'm curious to see if even the starting point is $500 million now. But I will give his agent credit. He has begun the selling part of this process. And that's what you have to do. Everything has to be fine. Everything has to be optimistic. You have to get every single person that has anything to do with this on the same page that this is going to be very, very successful. This is going to make him the exact same player he was before. Maybe even a little better. I don't know. Sell it. Quote, this is what the agent said. Quote, Shohei is going to be fine. Is he going to pitch the rest of the year? No, we already know that. Is he going to get into it next year? We don't know yet. See, remember the initial diagnosis was Shohei was not going to pitch next year? Remember he was going to go into the offseason with sort of the knowledge of everybody that he will be needing at least a year rehab so that he could hit, but he won't pitch until 2025. But here is the agent already kind of putting the cloud of, yeah, maybe. Just bear with me on that. But I do know this, no matter what the timetable we're dealing with and when we get this done, Shohei's going to be in somebody's lineup next year, DHing when the bell rings. We know that. We're not going to push that. He's going to be good to go. No one's arguing that. No one is bringing that up as a problem. No one's even questioning whether or not he can hit 50 home runs for you next season. But his 50 home runs is a DH who hits 50 home runs for you, plus a couple of other hits and whatnot. Is he worth $500 million with the hope that he'll be an effective pitcher once the rehab starts? The answer to that is no. The answer to that is no. You're not setting the bar in Major League Baseball on half of Shohei Ohtani. That's not happening. Shohei Ohtani is a fantastic hitter. He's not going down as the greatest hitter in Major League Baseball history. He's not even going to go down in Major League Baseball history as the greatest pitcher. But he is going to go down as the greatest player in Major League Baseball because of the two things combined. That's where you get the $500 million, if not six. Had this not happened, we'd had a fun time this offseason wondering what that number is going to be. Who's going to go crazy? Who's going to do it? Who's going to make that move? Who's going to make that one final push? Which owner is going to say, fine, an extra 50, make it an extra 50. Just make sure he's signed. But now, the owners now have the ability to say, yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, but here's the deal. I can go to four, but I can't go beyond that. That's what's going to be interesting. So don't be surprised if from now until we do get to the offseason, if you don't start hearing about how Shohei Ohtani is going to shock everybody with the quickest, fastest recovery from this surgery ever. Even though that may not be true. This is another quote. This guy loves the game. When he found out there's nothing that he can do to create any more damage than what's already been done, he was like, I'm going to play this thing out until we garner more information to make the right decision. That's where we're at. That's where we are as of today. That's, again, a selling point. Oh, yeah, Shohei Ohtani. He's not going to get out of the lineup. Now, he was last night for a little tightness in the oblique, but it's like a standard sort of take a seat, rest up a day. He does plan to continue along. He does plan to continue to hit this season, but I would too. If the, if, if I'm, If I have a pitching injury that doesn't affect my batting, but I stay out of the batting in the final month of the season, I wouldn't want that on my record when I go to free agency. I would not be surprised if in the end, the best plan of attack is to get a 2-year deal with the Angels done and then try this again down the road. But I don't know the owners and their willingness to grab the biggest prize in baseball, even if it's tainted. I don't know if I trust them enough to not make this guy super wealthy more than any player in the history of the sport, even if he's damaged goods right now, in the hopes that he will be what he once was. Because I know this about owners. They can't help themselves. It is an ego contest. It is, I got the guy, you didn't. I flexed my wallet more than you. There's always one, two, or three to make this really fun and really interesting. All right, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. We will continue. We've got a little U.S. Open talk coming up at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk about the Open, especially on the men's side, as three Americans are in the quarterfinals, and that's the first time in a while that that's happened. Chris Otto is going to join us to talk about that. I want to know what's happening to the state of male tennis in the United States. We'll also talk about Carlos Alcaraz, as well as Djokovic, and the rest of the tournament as it continues. That's coming up at the bottom of the hour. On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. We continue.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, again, Chris Otto will join us. We'll talk U.S. Open tennis down to the quarterfinals. Play today at Flushing Meadows. By the way, the United States beat Italy at the FIBA World Cup. I'm not following that because the games are like early in the morning and whatnot, and
yeah,
I'm just assuming the U.S. is going to win.
Either.
But they won. They beat Italy 100-63. These games are being played in Manila in the Philippines.
All right.
And you know who is paying attention, though? Yeah. You know who is paying attention?
Who's that?
Brian Windhorst.
Oh.
He is out there covering this United States run to the FIBA World Cup. And it's hot in Manila.
All right. Does he like his career?
I got to be honest with you. I think he does. Has he become the number one basketball reporter?
Well, here's
not the breaking news guy like
no, he's
Woj,
not Woj,
but like a guy they send out for every major basketball thing.
Well, here's my deal. Here's the thing, right? We all know he came to prominence because he decided to cover a 16-year-old kid who was playing in Akron,
Ohio. He was a local Ohio reporter that jumped on the LeBron James track. Yeah,
and you know, got the inside track. You know, befriended LeBron. And because he befriended LeBron, he became the most, you know, LeBron's helped him out, basically built his career. And the reason why I ask this, okay, is not, you know, I mean, yeah, he has a great career for any. I mean, anybody would want that. But for the longest time, he was able to stay at home and just cover this kid.
That's right.
From the confines of his own house, ESPN would you know, fly him out to different games and stuff like that. But, I mean, you know, they would always go to him, and he could just be sitting in his home office and talk to you about the happenings of LeBron James.
He did move to Miami from Ohio to cover Miami, cover the Heat when LeBron was on it. But I don't think he moved to L.A.
I don't think he did either.
To finish it out. I think they went back to Cleveland. And then his career sort of broke off, and then he became like – a guy covering playoff games and regular games and just bouncing around the league.
Now it's no longer, it's like, well, we don't need 24/7 LeBron saturation anymore.
We don't need that as much.
So that's why I was asking, like, you know, I know they sent him to France to go know, look at Wembanyama, and now he's in the Philippines. I'm like, does he miss the old days where he just got to stay at home and everyone came to him?
I don't know. Like, I keep thinking about this with the FIBA World Cup. It's like, would I enjoy being out there for as long as that tournament is, just covering international games? I mean, if I love basketball, yes, but it's not the number one thing going on right now.
Yeah.
It's not even in the conscious of the American sports public. Well, I don't think sports fans are even know where the U.S. stands in this thing.
Right. All I saw is that the other day is that they lost, and I saw the thing.
They lost to Lithuania.
They lost to Lithuania in the second round. But it's like, don't worry, the quarterfinals start soon. And I was like, well, okay, wait, you lost in the second round. Aren't you eliminated?
Yeah, I thought you were eliminated. I don't even get the format.
That doesn't make any sense to me. But it's not even in the consciousness of the world. If this is a true World Cup, imagine, you know, when we have the Soccer World Cup, you shut everything down.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously,
the NFL kept on rolling, marching along. But, we had that great sports weekend during Thanksgiving, where it was Thanksgiving football on a Friday. We had USA versus England on Black Friday. Then you had some rivalry matchups happening that Saturday. I mean, it was a great weekend of the sport.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I couldn't even tell you what channel this is on.
Yeah, I don't even think it's on. Is it on a channel?
Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm giving it too much credit.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, is it on NBA TV?
Who's on the team? Do you even know who's on the team?
Oh, like Anthony Edwards is on the team.
Right, okay.
I'm trying to think of a couple of other players that are on it. Not really. I mean, Jalen Brunson is on the team. Josh Hart is on the team. Malcolm Bridges. I'm looking through. Bobby Portis. Tyler Halliburton. Paolo Banchero is on the team.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
So, I mean, people you've heard of.
But they, you know, but I think it's 40 minutes. It's only 10-minute quarters in international basketball. There's a bunch of other little rules.
Yeah, Karl-Anthony Towns is playing for the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. Giannis was going to play for Greece, but I think decided not to or something like that. They couldn't play.
Thanasis?
His brother's
playing.
Like, I'm looking at the Italy roster, and I don't see anybody I recognize from the NBA. No, there isn't. But yeah, no, it's but Brian Winhurst is out there in Manila in the heat of the Philippines, bringing us all the latest from Team USA. Like, I watched his report this morning, and it was really good. He was like, hey, Team USA is trailed by double digits early in the last three games, and in the last two of the three games, they trailed at halftime. And I'm like, who's following it this closely? You're right. It's not even on the big radar. All right. You know who should be on the radar is Royce Lewis, the Minnesota Twins rookie, hit his third grand slam in the last eight games. You know what's surprising about this?
It's in Minnesota.
It's happening in Minnesota. That he had an opportunity. He had an opportunity to hit three grand slams in eight games. You don't get up with the bases loaded very often.
That's true.
That's not like an every game thing where you can count on, well, at least I'll come up to the bases loaded. You might go 2 weeks and not come to plate with the bases loaded.
But he said a
grand slam again. He said three grand slams in eight games. That's incredible. Guys have one grand slam a year. And he said three in a week and a half. That's crazy. And he's a rookie.
That's impressive.
Really is. Royce Lewis is the fourth player in Major League Baseball history and the first rookie to hit three grand slams in the span of eight games. Jim Northrup in 1968 hit three in the span of four games. Lou Gehrig hit three in the span of five games. And Lewis tied Larry Parrish with taking him eight games. Well, there you go. So that's just two bits of news that I wanted to get to clean up. Real quick, before we get to the U.S. Open tennis guest coming up at the bottom of the hour. So I went to the mall yesterday. My wife and I were picking up a couple of things. We decided, why not? Let's go to the mall. Nobody goes to the mall anymore.
No.
Right? It's not even a thing. But anyway, we wanted to pick up a couple of things. And it was like, cool, we go out. So her and I went out to the mall. We got in, and there was a, you know how like sometimes at the mall, it's not an official store, but somebody just opens up something in the middle of the mall?
The kiosk.
Yeah, kiosk. Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Kiosks. Right. So like you can get calendars at the holidays, right? You know, things like that. Somebody's always like, would you like perfume or would you like a massage or whatever?
Those perfume people are annoying, by the way.
Yeah, they really are because they never let you go. And I'm like,
come on. Hey.
My wife's got a bunch of these. I don't need them anymore. Bye.
Yeah, but you don't have the newest one. You don't have this one. Right. You don't have it in the 3.5 ounce bottle.
So when I walked in right away, there was a guy, and he had a huge tables, just table after table after table, and he was selling sports collectibles. And it was like, I almost said to my wife, do you mind if I spend like 10, 15 minutes looking at this stuff. I was going through it. Like, I'm not kidding, man. I found cards. He was selling baseball cards and football cards. And I looked down and I pointed to my wife and I said, I had that card. I had that card. I had a bunch of those cards. I'm just going down. You know what he had that just brought me back to my childhood, though? Remember starting lineup collectible figures?
Yes.
Do you remember that? He had a zillion of them.
In the packaging?
In the packaging.
See, now how did you...
How were you smart enough back then to keep it in the packaging?
I mean, I always think about that. Because, you know, that's true with, like, our toy figurines, whether it was Star Wars characters or G.I. Joe or anything, or any type of toy we got when a kid. What kid said, I'm going to keep it in the box?
Absolutely.
I'm going to keep it. I mean, I would tear into those action figures and, it would have looked like it was just mutilated by an animal.
Saturday Night Live did a funny bit on that where they had it's the new Star Wars collectible play sets. And they had kids wanting to play with them, but the adults were like, no, keep it in the box. Never open it. Never open it. And that's like, imagine if you went back in time and you went back to your young self and you went, yeah, you know that Yoda? You don't even open it. You'd be like, what? No, trust me. The Obi-Wan Kenobi, don't touch it. Just leave it in the case.
And the Luke Skywalker.
Can I take this TIE fighter out? No. It'll be better if it just stays in the box.
I mean, because the figures that I had, the arms didn't even bend.
Yeah.
That's how old they were.
And so that
it was like
that,
he raised the lightsaber that, I mean, it came out of the hand, came through the arm.
That's right. Yeah. The little holder and you went up and down. Yeah. But he had the starting lineup figures like Don Mattingly, Wade Boggs.
I mean, again,
John Elway football, like Dan Marino. These were great.
I had a few of those as well, but again, tore open it was my life depended on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cool autograph stuff too. Like he had a bunch of that kind of thing.
We have do you have a store? I think it's a chain called Field of Dreams.
No, I don't. But I've heard of it. I've heard of
something like
of Dreams,
that where it's just memorabilia. And
yep, I've heard of that.
I walk through there sometimes. And I'm like, God, I could lose a lot of money.
I know. I kept thinking about that. I almost went to the guy and I said, "Listen, man, do you have a 1978 Topps Terry Bradshaw? That was my favorite card when I was a kid." You have that, I'll buy it. I'll give you anything you want.
Ooh, don't say that to him.
I know, because he'll be like, now that's valued at $1,200.
Yeah, you lost your edge right there.
I know. If I could get any set in its entirety, it'd be the 1978 Topps football card.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsNet Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, we're scheduled to hook up with Chris Otto. He's with Now.com covering the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament, and we want to talk to him because we're at the quarterfinal stage. Later today, Coco Gauff is going to be in action on the women's side. But the men's side, we've got three Americans. But the big story, of course, Novak Djokovic, Carlos Alcaraz. So Chris Otto joins us from Now.com. How are you?
Tony, good, man. How are you? Nice to
speak with
you.
Appreciate your time. Thank you so much. It's on a Progressive guest line. Round out your protection with life, phone, and pet health insurance. Visit them for a quote at progressive.com. All right, let's get right to the men's side of it. I mean, listen, I get the story, Djokovic, I get Alcaraz, but how strong are the three Americans that are left in the quarterfinals?
Well, very strong and very young. That's the key takeaway probably with the three Americans that we've got and still in the draw. Ben Shelton, explosive, lowest ranked player left in the tournament, but just 20 years of age and really just cutting his teeth on the ATP tour. He's been quite a revelation this week. And then you got Francis Tiafoe, 25 years old rather, and backing up his semifinal run last year with another good performance. And then Taylor Fritz, the top-ranked American, also relatively young. So it's an exciting group of players. May not be a title from any of the three, but it's definitely high hopes for the future of American tennis.
Where has the American men's tennis side gone in the last few? I mean, they said this is the first time three Americans have been in the quarterfinals at the U.S. Open in quite a while. Where has it gone? Where do you think it's heading?
Since 2005 would be correct, yes. It's been a while since we've had three this far at the U.S. Open. you know, things have changed in the last couple of decades, but I think the main reason we haven't seen many Americans around is the big three have dominated this men's game like no other era. This Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, they've basically gobbled up all the Grand Slam titles, and for many years there were three of the four semifinalists at these majors. There wasn't many opportunities for players anywhere else and by any other name than those three.
Djokovic is getting older, and they were wondering about the Wimbledon, like, is father time creeping in? What have you seen from him, and is father time making his presence felt in Djokovic's game?
Well, there's no doubt that father time is going to creep in ever so subtly. At the age of 36, he's bidding to be the oldest men's singles champion at Flushing Meadows, and I mean, that's definitely a difficult task that lies ahead of him. And we saw what happened at Wimbledon, where he was taken out by Carlos Alcaraz, a 20-year-old phenom, and we could very well see those two meet in the final again. Nevertheless, it's amazing what Djokovic is able to do. Of course, he's bidding for his 24th major singles title that would tie him on the all-time list with the great Margaret Court. He's done things that no other man has done. He's surpassed Nadal and Federer in Grand Slam singles titles, and he wants more, and I think he's playing well enough to get more. It's just a matter of what Carlos Alcaraz might have to say about that, and if they do meet in the final.
What are you guys in the tennis world talking about Alcaraz, and how are you comparing him at such a young age to the guys that you mentioned before and even some of the guys down in the history of this sport?
Oh, yeah, He's remarkable. What's beautiful about him is that he's got such a complete game at such a young age. I mean, he's not relying on one shot. He's not relying on a forehand, a backhand, a serve. He's got everything. He's built this foundation of a game that works on any surface against any type of player. He's good on clay. He's obviously good on grass. Now he's a Wimbledon champion. I mean, he's 20 years old, and he's already got two Grand Slam titles. That's pretty much instant Hall of Fame status, and it looks like he can win many, many more because he's separating himself from his other peers. I mean, there's a whole generation of players that we thought may be the next in line to become the next great player, and it just never materialized. We're talking about guys in around their mid-20s now, guys like Alexander Zverev, maybe even a Daniil Medvedev, both of them are still alive in this tournament, by the way. But Carlos has proven to be a cut above, and here in New York, he just embraces the spotlight like no other player. He's good under pressure. It's just remarkable what he's been able to do, and pretty much everybody you talk to at this tournament, in the media room and all around, is raving about how good he is. It's just a matter of whether he can follow through on that success. There's still a long way to go. I mean, you know, he still only has the two Grand Slams, and there's still a lot of people gunning for him. He's got that target on his back, but so far, so good for this kid. He's been amazing to watch.
I look at these majors, and I compare him to golf in a way. Like, in golf, you've got Augusta, and then the U.S. Open has something, and then the British Open has something. And then in tennis, you got the grass courts at Wimbledon, the clay at Roland Garros, the hard court of Australia and New York. But what is it about the U.S. Open? Is there something that the U.S. Open has that players have to overcome that's just different than the other Grand Slam events?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's the amount of energy that it takes to kind of cope with the things that are going on in New York. The travel to and from the tournament site is a little more different. The heat can be oppressive, the humidity particularly, and we're seeing that this week. And the fact that it's at the end of a long season, we're in September here. These guys have been grinding away on tour for 8-9 months, and I think that's the reason why a man hasn't been able to successfully defend this title since Roger Federer in 2008. You get a lot of surprise champions. You have people troubling to repeat their titles. And I think it has to do with the fact that it's at the end of the year, and these guys are really kind of like limping into this tournament in many ways. And it's just a tough one to keep it together for. And then you add to that the pressure, the crowds, the intensity, the late night vibes. It's a real energy drain for a lot of players.
Who is coming up in the tennis world as Djokovic gets older and moves on? Who is coming up that Alcaraz could grab onto and create the same sort of trend that we've seen over the last 20 years?
A couple of guys are kind of on their way up, but you know what? They both got bounced from this tournament, so it really just shows us how difficult it might be for Jannik Sinner, who we saw have a brilliant quarterfinal with Alcaraz last night, and actually held a match, last year, and actually held a match point. Last night he was taken out in round of 16 by Alexander Zverev, but he's a guy we think generally has a really bright future. At the age of 22, he's projecting to be maybe future Grand Slam champion and a rival for Alcaraz. And there's also a guy named by the name of Holger Rune, who's done tremendous things at the age of 20, but he was bounced in the first round here in New York, so you never can tell.
Let's go to the women's side, and Coco Gauff is going to be in action today. What would it mean if she were to win a U.S. Open? What would it mean for American women's tennis?
Oh, it would just be amazing. The fact that she's still just a teenager. I mean, tennis fans and sports fans are pretty familiar with Coco Gauff. She's been on the scene for about 4 years since she broke out at Wimbledon as a 15-year-old. But, you know, it would just be remarkable to see somebody, you know, kind of climb to the mantle and win a Grand Slam. We have a lot of great players. American women's tennis is just fine. There's a total depth of talent there. But to have somebody break through and win a slam and maybe at the age of 19 and point to a bright future, maybe a multiple slam winner, would just be amazing. And she's really coming into her own this tournament and this summer. So there's a possibility that she can do it.
I always find it interesting because I have a lot of friends who are really into tennis and they watch it and they'll stay up late to watch the Australian Open and they'll get up early to watch Wimbledon. And they talk about in their posts, they'll talk about Coco Gauff, about needing to see Coco Gauff. They can't wait to see Coco Gauff. And I'm wondering if that, how much that is affecting her even at a young age, that she is becoming the draw that people seem to want to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think she embraces that pressure. I think she's a pretty level-headed kid, got great parents, and I think she's really been good about accepting the pressure that she's faced with. She's definitely under the spotlight and has been for many years, and I think people maybe even had some expectations, maybe got a little bit ahead of themselves with what her potential is. She's taking it all in stride, and I think that's very important for a young player like her. She's able to just deal with it and kind of look inward, and she what she expects from herself to her in her mind is what's most important. And I think she's got a pretty healthy sense of perspective.
How do you handicap the quarterfinals on the women's side of the U.S. Open?
Oh, wow. It's going to be very tricky. Of course, we've got Coco Gauff and the Latvian Yelena Ostapenko coming on court on Ash in a little bit. And I think that's a coin toss because Ostapenko just took out the defending champion and number one seed, Iga Świątek, and she's on fire. She's the type of player that can take the racket out of anybody's hand, hits with so much power. And then you've also got Aryna Sabalenka. She's the number two seed on the lower half of the draw, and she is going to be the new number one after the U.S. Open. And I think she's probably in the lead and maybe could be considered the favorite by many. But I think, you know, there's still eight women left, and I think it's pretty wide open for all the reasons we talked about earlier, which is the pressure of New York and the fact that a lot of players have been through a lot this season. And you get some pretty random results at these Grand Slams. We've already seen the top seed go out, and I probably would expect a few more surprises on the women's side.
Yeah, well, even with football heading into the seasons and everyone's excited about that, the U.S. Open has always had a very, very solid place this time of year. Thank you so much for your time and analysis of what we may see in this next week.
I appreciate it. It was great to be on.
You got it. Chris Otto again, now.com covering tennis, the U.S. Open. Hey, listen, I remember, like, you'd watch, and again, it depends on what era you were going in, but I remember, like, football weekends, that like, CBS would have a game, and then they would go right to the championship. They would go to, like, Pete Sampras against whoever. And I know I'm dating myself, but that's how it used to be. Pat Summerall used to call tennis for CBS. So he would have a game where he wasn't with John Madden. He'd be with the tennis team for CBS, getting ready to broadcast right after your early football game on Sunday, the championship match. That was, I mean, again, I'm dating myself. That was a long time ago, but that's the way it used to be. So, but it always has had a strong presence. A lot of it, New York. It is the final major. It is our U.S. Open. So even in the rain of football that is coming down on us, the U.S. Open always had a solid spot. All right, coming up, I'm going to wrap up the show. Are we missing a Labor Day tradition? I was just thinking about this yesterday and wanted to bring it up in a conversation to close out the hour.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, thanks to Chris Otto at now.com. A little setup for the U.S. Open. I know some of you probably don't pay attention to rounds one and two and whatnot, but quarterfinals is when things are getting more fun.
Well, it gets interesting.
Yeah. Coco Gauff is going to be in action in a bit against Ostapenko. Then you've, in the men's side, like I said, they've got the three men. Ben Shelton played at the University of Florida, going up against Francis Tiafoe. That's going to be tonight. And then you got Taylor Fritz. He'll go up against Djokovic. Hopefully, maybe he can make it count and maybe go a little longer. But I think, you know, Djokovic is too strong. Alcaraz is playing later on. They have a to be determined. And Medvedev is also going to be playing later on. So there's your rough quarterfinals. So I was thinking about this yesterday because it was Labor Day weekend. And I was, you know, kind of running some errands and having fun. And it always, every time I get to Labor Day, I always, you know, obviously I'm geared up for football. I'm geared up for the college football start of the NFL season. It's my one of my favorite times of the year. And I think a lot of it is the anticipation of what the summer is. You know, you go through the summer, you're grasping at news, you're trying to find some things that click, you're doing some oddball stuff. And then you get to football season and things are just, you know, much easier to sort of present news and topics. But I also remembered what it was like for me as a kid. And when I was younger, I went to school after Labor Day. So today, yeah, for example, would have been the day I would have started school. Maybe Wednesday, but we always started right after Labor Day. And Labor Day was also a day that my dad was home. And inevitably, my memories of Labor Day as a kid were, because we lived in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire and winter was coming, it was like my dad and his friend like chopping wood, and me and my brother are like taking wood pieces in the afternoon to make a pile for the winter and whatnot, you know, because we had a wood burning stove and all that stuff. But you know what I remember the most about Labor Day was the Jerry Lewis telethon. That was a part of my life all through my life until what, 5 or 6 years ago when they stopped. Jerry Lewis passed away, I think, in 2017. Maybe like he lived to be very old. But I think they stopped the telethon 2015. It was then hosted by other people. Jerry Lewis stopped hosting it like mid-2000s, I want to say. But he'd been hosting it from like 1960-something all the way through. And every single year was the Jerry Lewis telethon. If you're old enough to remember this, it was on every single channel. That was it. That was the only thing that was on Labor Day. ABC, NBC, CBS, whatever your local affiliate was, it was irrelevant. There were no soap operas. There was nothing on Labor Day. The only thing that was on was the telethon. And every station had its own, like, smaller telethon number that you would call. They'd show some people standing by those phones, raising money for muscular dystrophy. And then there would be, like, they would have some local people. Like, you would have a local television station, and they would go, like, and we just want to say thank you to the Hanover Fire Department. Here is Chief John Smith with a check for $1,000. Thank you so much. Yeah, we had a bake sale. I want to thank everybody who came out for the bake sale to raise money. We just want to present this check for $1,000. Then they would do their local stuff, and then, boom, they'd go to Jerry Lewis. The national stuff would kick in at various times, and Jerry Lewis would be like, all right, now give it up for Charo. And Charo would come out. She'd do coochie, coochie, coochie. They would have some axe play. Maybe Sinatra would come out, say hi, sing a song. And then Ed McMahon, they'd go to the tote board. Remember, they'd go to the tote board and they'd go, let's go. And then they would go, and they would show what they would raise. And it was a major deal. It was a major, major thing. And I started thinking to myself, in 2023, telethons, do they work? I don't think they work anymore.
I don't even think they exist.
You don't have to do telethons.
The last one we had telethon that was like national, wasn't it for like Harvey? Or not for Harvey, for Katrina?
Yeah, but exactly. Like, you don't even need telethons in this day and age.
No, you don't.
You can just go text blah, blah, blah to blah, 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 and automatically $10 will go to a Red Cross relief. All you got to do is just text.
Yeah.
And they'll just add $10 to your phone bill, then that money will go to the Red Cross.
Yep.
Covering this event, this thing.
Yeah, like the Maui fires.
Right, right.
Right. You might see a commercial spot or something like that, and it'll just be the Red Cross saying, text 55055.
And I'm not trying to think that we were crueler back then, but let's be honest what the telethon was during Labor Day weekend. Jerry Lewis and his team worked tirelessly to bring you entertainment galore in hopes that you will exchange Charo, Frank Sinatra, Jose Feliciano, like you name it, in hopes that you would give money to muscular dystrophy in exchange for the entertainment they gave you on TV. Nowadays, there's no entertainment needed. Joe Buck comes on TV during a football game and goes, hey, the NFL is partnering up with the Red Cross for relief efforts for Haiti. Text blah, 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 and there you go. That's it. But you didn't need the football game as they didn't give you the football game in hopes that you would do that. They were giving you the football game anyway.
God, that's fine. Right? I haven't thought about that in years.
Right.
You just mentioned it.
That's
the only thing that pops in my mind now is will the Jerry Lewis telethon be a Mandela effect?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We all sit back and go, do you remember this? Oh, that didn't exist. What?
Yeah.
Swear to God it existed.
It was the most important thing on Labor Day television. And listen, you're a kid and I couldn't imagine somebody staying up 25 hours on a telethon. Like now I'm older, I get it. I've done overnights, I've done long days. But when you're a kid, you're like, how is he even alive? Doesn't he need to go to bed? No, he doesn't need to go to bed. He's fighting for MDA. That's what he's doing. So at the end of the telethon, Jerry Lewis had like his tuxedo tie was hanging off his neck. His shirt's unbuttoned. He might not even have a jacket on. He'd get there. He would sing Never Walk Alone. And that would be closing out the telethon. And that was it. And there was always some corporate president that was coming on TV to present Jerry Lewis. Though your friends at McDonald's, here is a check for $1 million or something like that. And he did that thing every year for like 50 years.
By the time Monday night came along, he looked horrible.
Oh, he looked beat up. He looked beat up.
Tie was always undone because he wore a tux.
He wore a tux the whole time.
He wore a tux.
The whole time since the start of the event till the time it ended, 21 hours, That tuxedo
and
was
I'll
on
let
him.
You know some of the kids. He wasn't wearing a clip-on either.
No,
because that tie was undone, hanging down. Top a couple buttons were off, and his eyes were just. I mean, he looked like death.
That's right. He'd have the stories of the kids fighting MDA would be on, and and again, all it was to get you to go. You know what, Janice, give me the phone. And you'd call. I remember as a kid calling. Like, I can remember as a kid calling and donating, like, $10. And I'd be, you'd pick up the phone and you'd call and some operator would call. And I had no idea. Like, did my parents just get a bill in the mail? Like, how did we send the money? Did my dad later on just get, like, a letter from MDA going, yeah, we got a call from your house.
Yeah, you promised.
That you promised that you would give $10 to this event. I mean, now it's like it's easy. It's like it's you can raise money instantly.
And
you don't have to put on a telethon. Yeah.
Yeah. No need
to
do that.
You can just go to the Cash App. You go to the Venmo. Like you can just boom. Here you go.
There are some people now. I mean, you've seen it. Like where, a college football game. They always show it for college game day where somebody's like, I need beer. Venmo me, and he puts his Venmo number, and before he knows it, he has like a couple $100.
Oceans and oceans of people delivering him money.
Like, where was that when I was a kid?
Like, seriously, this was set in Las Vegas, which for a kid in New Hampshire might as well have been on Mars because it was so glitzy even then. It was like Jerry Lewis is in Vegas at the Sahara Hotel just hanging out with Ed McMahon, looking up at the tote board. Here comes Frank Sinatra and, hanging out. I think it was Dean Martin even made an appearance back in the day, in the days as they reunited for this telethon. That's, what's funny? For a long time as I was a kid growing up, that's all I knew Jerry Lewis was.
Yeah.
Was the guy, the host of the telethon. Like, I had no idea he had a famous act with Dean Martin. I didn't know he was in a bunch of movies. And it wasn't until I was older that I kind of grasped, like, who he was, like, how big of a personality he was.
And then when you saw him, like, the first time, let me ask you, like, when you saw him for the first time in one of those old movies or old TV shows with Dean Martin or without Dean Martin, were you surprised? It was like, whoa, dude, he's, like, really, really weird.
Yeah,
and
no
crazy.
Doubt. Yeah.
You know, it was like almost like Pee Wee Herman-ish.
Nutty Professor and all that. Yeah.
Just the way he talked and he's like, how?
You got Tony like, or, yeah.
You like sat back and went like, is that really the same guy? Because this guy's really uber serious.
Exactly. He'd be like, okay, all right, America. Right now we got the incredible Tony Orlando and Don. Tony Orlando, take it away. Thank you, Jerry. And they would just dance and sing and then the people would call and call and call around the country. Yeah, like, I like that Tony Orlando. Give me that phone. Yeah, Jerry Lewis Telethon, big Labor Day tradition gone.